Speaking today with Dr. Steve Murdoch, who is the former demographer for the state of Texas and now the director of the Hobby Center for the Study of Texas at Rice University. Dr. Murdoch, the first question I have to ask, what exactly does the state demographer of Texas do?
Well, the state demographer of Texas does a number of things. It advises state legislature and state entities on important demographic trends. Probably the thing that most people know is that they do official set of estimates and set of projections that are used for long-term planning and budgetary analysis by state agencies. So they look at the future, what they think will happen in terms of the population of Texas, what parts will grow, what parts will not grow so rapidly, and the changes in characteristics from age, race, ethnicity, to household composition, to a wide range of factors that influence state spending and state growth.
Okay, well, I'm gonna ask you some specific questions about that. But after that, you were director of the Census for a while.
Census Bureau during the last part of the Bush administration, then of course left office when there was a change of administration in 2000, early 2009.
Now, of course, we just had a census. We're starting to get data for all of our group. Do you have any opinion on how it was conducted?
Well, I think the census went quite well. I mean, there will be areas, and there's always people in parts of the country that feel like they were undercounted. There are parts of Texas, I think, that have some concerns. But I think the data overall tend to look like they were pretty good. And the reason for knowing that is that one of the things that demographers do, can keep track of pretty well, is there's three factors that drive population growth: births, deaths, and migration. And migration for a state is migration from other states and, of course, immigration from other countries. Births and deaths we have a good handle on in the United States. There are very few unregistered births anymore, and virtually no unregistered deaths. So we have a good handle on that, and that's about the combination of births and deaths, sometimes called natural increase, account for about two-thirds of the growth in the United States, or the change, up or down. And then migration and immigration is a lot of part of that. And we have some, at the national level, we have pretty good data in terms of immigration, and immigration is kept, of course, by Homeland Security. And we have now fairly... nobody knows how good, but we have estimates as well of undocumented immigration. So undocumented plus the documented immigration is the third factor. And these suggest, looking at them year by year, comparing them to the census count, suggest that the census was probably pretty complete across the country.
Were there anything in the data that's come out so far that surprised you?
I guess I'm surprised. I have been someone for some time who has been saying that in some many important ways, the Texas of today is the U.S. of tomorrow. What I think is surprising is that U.S. of tomorrow is a lot closer tomorrow than I thought it was. In other words, we've been seeing just extensive growth in the Hispanic population of Texas and non-Anglo populations. But that is clearly... now the norm in the United States. We got the last of the state data released yesterday, so when you add them all up and look at them, what you see is just some phenomenal patterns of change. For example, in about 34 of the 50 states, the absolute increase in Hispanic populations exceeded the increase in non-Hispanic white or Anglo populations. We saw substantially faster Asian growth and African-American growth. In Texas, for example, we had an increase of about 464,000 Anglos, an increase of nearly 2.8 million Hispanics, and an increase of 522,000 African-Americans and 390,000 Asians. Now, that large difference between Hispanics and other groups. But even African Americans, who are 11.5% of our population compared to the 45% of our population that is Anglo, even that population group exceeded in growth that of the Anglo population. And so we are seeing state after state. You take the largest state in the country, to the state of California, and it's a state about 12 million larger than our 25.1 million people that we had in Texas in our 2010 count. In that state, the increase in the Hispanic population was about 3.1 million. The change in the Anglo population was a decline of 861,000 people. So the change in the demographics, the diversification of the U.S. population is no longer just a Texas and California and a few states. It's an increasingly national phenomenon. In fact, it's not too much of an exaggeration to say that if you look across the country, if you are not diverse, you are not growing. So that if you look at the, you know, states like the Iowas and the Midwest and the Great Plains states, many of them are struggling. They're not losing population. Only one state lost population, and that was Michigan. But their growth is much less than it is in states that are more diverse. What that's meant is that the South and West have continued a pattern that's been evident at the starting the beginning of the 20th century all the way to the 2010 census from 1900 to 2010. Here's the pattern you see. In 1900, 62% of the U.S. population lived in the Northeast and Midwest, meaning 38% lived in the South and the West. As of this census, 40% live in the Northeast and Midwest, and 60% live in the South and the West. And if you begin to look at what population growth rates have been, etc., what you see is that the South and the West is also much more diverse, containing 75% of the Hispanic population, about 65% or so of the African American population, etc. So being diverse has been important for growth in the United States for a long time now.
You know, I read so much in the newspapers about the census, about what you've just been talking about, the explosive growth in the Latino community and the, you know, slow to non-existent growth in among Anglos. What exactly accounts for that? Why is there such a difference? Immigration is some of it, obviously.
Yeah. But immigration is not, one of the things that people, I think, tend to misunderstand is that, particularly in a state like Texas, yes, immigration is part of it, but it's not the major force. The major force for growth in Texas is natural increase, the excess of births over deaths. And part of the difference you have, and it's a nationwide phenomenon, it's actually a worldwide phenomenon, is that if you take Anglo populations, their fertility has been below replacement levels since the mid-1970s. So, if you've got really two sources of population growth, natural increase, the excess of births and deaths, and the other one is immigration, then when you're when you look at the Anglo population, fertility is below replacement, meaning you're not replenishing that population from natural increase, and your population's aging. So your proportion of deaths is increasing as well.
I imagine those two are related.
And they're related. And so, for example, one of the things that the Census Bureau noted yesterday, that if you take the non-Hispanic white population, the average non-Hispanic white is 41 years of age. Well, if you start looking at that relative to women in reproduction, that means that we're getting a population that's largely through reproductive ages. So when you look at that component, that is natural increase, excess births over deaths, that's been below replacement for some time. And when you look at immigration to replenish what most people think of as of Anglos, those are people of European stock. Europe is the slowest growing part of the world, the oldest part of the world in terms of its population base, and the only part of the world that the United Nations, the only region of the world that the United Nations projects to lose population between now and 2050. So there isn't a lot of stock there of immigrants to come to impact that non-Hispanic white population base. So as time goes on, increasingly unlikely that there's going to be some massive replenishment of the Anglo population. Now, that doesn't mean it's going to go out of existence. It simply means that it's going to become an increasingly smaller part of the population base of the United States, such that the Census Bureau and a set of projections released in 2008 suggested that by 2042, the U.S. would become what Texas became in about 2003, less than half non-Hispanic white. And that by that time period of time, about 30% of the population in the United States would be Hispanic. So we're seeing, you know, these dramatic changes that we used to think of as, yeah, that was occurring in California and Texas and, you know, some of the southwestern states. But these patterns are increasingly national patterns.
And again, my assumption is that the reason for the change, you know, the replacement, you know, the natural growth rate declining is, you know, Anglos over time, and this may be a matter of income level, maybe a matter of other societal changes, they tend to get married later and start having kids later, and so the generations are far farther apart. Is that, well, is that something to that?
In general, what we've seen in the United States is extensive. We have the oldest age of first marriage now in the history of the country. We had this occur, by the way, the last time it was about this old was in the Great Depression, okay, when people were marrying later because of the cost of setting up a family and so forth. We have that pattern going on with Anglos, and less so with particularly Hispanics. In fact, much of the difference in fertility with Hispanics versus others is that the younger age at which fertility starts. So they're much more likely to have children in their late teens and early 20s than is true of Anglo populations. So you see, there are a number of factors that enter into this. I think the important thing is to understand is the change is occurring. It doesn't necessarily have some kind of substantial impacts, depending on what we do or do not do.
Okay.
As a state and as a nation.
Now, as you said, when you were a state demographer, your role was essentially to advise the legislature about this kind of change that's going on so that they could plan accordingly, in their budget.
Right.
I mean, the legislature is in session now, and as we know, even though Texas is growing rapidly, the budget is going to be shrinking from what it was 2 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
What impact do you foresee that having on Texas population?
Yeah, I get, one thing in fairness to everyone is to understand that about a third of that budget problem is self-induced by the Texas legislature. That is, they passed a property tax decline when they didn't, and it was going to be replaced by a tax that, in fact, everybody knew at the time would never be able to match the reduction. Very same folks that did that are still there. So that's just, I think it's important for people to understand that this isn't all just the economy. Some of this is some unfortunate decisions that were made a couple of sessions ago. I think the other thing to understand is that it is in times like this when we look to our elected officials for leadership. And I'm not my job to criticize anybody in power, but I am very concerned about this session. Because when you look at the demographics of Texas, you look at the number of kids that we have, and we look at what they need in terms of educational attainment in order to retain our state competitiveness, our state wealth, cutting education is about the last thing in the world you want to do, because we are severe problems in that particular area. One of the things we did in a book called The Texas Challenge a few years ago was to look and say, what happens if nothing happens? What happens if the demographic changes that we project occur, but the socioeconomic differentials, the income, the education, the other kinds of differentials,
that exist between racial and ethnic groups don't change. And what happens if they do change? When we looked at it in terms of what happens if nothing changes, we found differences that suggested, for example, that the average Texas household in 2040 would be $6,500 poorer than it was in 2000 and 2000 constant dollars. We found out that our workforce that was already in 2000, 18% of our workforce had less than high school level of education. By 2040, we'd have 30% of our workforce with less than a high school level of education. And that, you know,
that's a, that figure in itself is one that says, you know, what's the chances of you being a high-tech state if 30% of your workforce doesn't have a high school degree? That's a very, very sobering, I think, to most of us statistic. On the other hand, if we close the educational gaps, because the single best predictor of wealth, of income, of all socioeconomic factors in the United States and has been since we started measuring this in the 30s and 40s, is education. If we close the educational gaps and they have the same kind of impacts that they've had historically, we could be a prosperous and more competitive state. We could, for example, we looked at the income just for part of the household structure because we couldn't get the data we need to look at the total. And you could see, for example, that we could add, by closing the gaps, add $300 billion per year to aggregate household income by closing the educational gaps. We could increase our competitiveness in terms of the employment patterns of our labor force. So include consumer expenditures by $200 and some billion per year. Now, those are very low estimates. Almost everybody that looks at them says, well, they would be much larger than that. The point of it is the key to ensuring the second future and not the first is education. And when you look at what we're suggesting to do in terms of education, take a good example, the Texas Grants Program, which is a program that helps kids with limited resources go to college. We're talking about doing away with almost all of that. That is very dangerous for the state of Texas. The Commissioner of Higher Education has said, and I agree with him, we're going to have a lost generation of college students. And I don't know if Texas can be the Texas that we want socioeconomically in the future if we lose a generation of college graduates. And so, there are some very difficult issues here. I know no one wants to have increased revenues, but sometimes you have to balance your approach. You have to have a balanced approach in order to get out of a rut. And this rut, done only on cuts and predominantly or many of them in education, I think is the wrong way to go.
Okay. So, you know, if this happens, if we do take this path of doing nothing or doing worse, do you foresee a way of recovering from that in the future?
Well, you know, I'm not a budgetary person in general.
I guess what I mean by that is, do you see Texas being able to catch up farther down the line in terms of educational achievement?
Well, you know, it's kind of like saying if you're limited on one leg and you're in a race and I kick you in the other leg, what's it going to take for you to win the race?
Right. Okay.
In other words, it's possible, you know, maybe someone comes along with a magic liniment and puts it on both legs and you just take off. But you probably would have a better chance if you still had one good leg. Okay. Well, that's probably a crude analogy. But the point is this, is that we have a big job in Texas if we were running full bore with our educational system and doing everything we could to increase educational attainment. Without that, taking away, and in fact taking two or three of the main factors that are impacting that, you start cutting the amount of increasing class size. What do we know about increased class size? Increased class size is less effective for particularly kids that are disadvantaged and don't have a mother at home that helps them every day after school because the mother's working and doing something else. What we know is that those kids need more help. And so when you
start taking money out of education, you start increasing class size, you start decreasing other kinds of programs, those kids become less competitive, they do less well, they compete less well, they make less money, and the state has less money. So if what we run a danger of here is that if most people that have looked at it non-linearly said we were going to have to hustle pretty hard before talking about these kind of cuts in order to remain competitive, we'll have a much more difficult job doing that down the road. Now, people say, well, maybe it's only a couple of years. Well, let's hope that's the case. But if it's a couple of years and you've got those kids that are freshmen and sophomore in college and they lose all their funding, they don't go to college. And now they're 2 or 3 years older down the road, they're more likely to have family obligations, etc. Many of those are not going to come back. How many is a problem for Texas? There's no way to quantify that at this point in time. But the reality of it is this is a very bad time for Texas to cut education. I cannot think of a time that would be much worse than right now. And I think, I would hope we would begin to, the session still have got some life in it. I would like folks to be thinking about the implications of that and not just thinking about that we can't do anything but cut.
One thing you sometimes hear in this discussion is that the undocumented immigrants, of which there are some number in Texas, I think 2 million maybe, I don't know what the estimate is.
The most recent estimate is somewhere between 1.4 and 1.6.
Okay. That they are a net drain on Texas's economy. Do you agree with that?
Well, let me tell you what the empirical data shows for the country, and it's been done by Pew Hispanic Center, it's been done by RAND, it's been done by all sets of reputable. They generally show the following for undocumented immigrants. Okay, they are a net plus at the national level because, despite what people think, many of them work for large companies. They get Social Security taken out, they get income tax taken out, and they'll never collect any Social Security. Okay? So, and if you've ever known anything about Social Security, look at it. If they get a number that's not an accurate number, the Social Security Administration doesn't spend a lot of time looking up and giving money back to people who they don't think have a Social Security number. In other words, we keep it. The national level, we keep that money. In fact, you can have a totally invalid Social Security number, and the Social Security Administration will still take that donation that comes from your employer when they pay it. And I'm not saying that's inappropriate to take it. I'm just simply saying that they do. The legislation shows, the analysis shows at that level they're net positive. At the state level, in most states, it's about a wash, okay? Because they use some state services, but they also pay sales tax and other taxes that go into the process. And thirdly, at this local level, yes, they tend to be a net loss in the sense that they impact education and they impact healthcare. And so both of those are impacted by it. Now, I think it's really important to look at why they're here, okay, and what role everyone plays in that process. Let's say some of the characteristics they have. They're more likely to be employed than citizens are. They are likely, of course, to be employed in lower cost jobs and positions. And some economists, at least, would argue that, in fact, they wouldn't be here if there wasn't a demand for people who would take jobs at lower pay levels. And the best example of that, and I encourage you to take a look at the Pew Center's analysis. I don't think anybody's ever accused them of any kind of political agenda. But I think that the Pew data show, for example, it's not just in a place like Texas or California. If you take nationwide, there are about a quarter, for example, of all the people in sheetrock work, about a quarter of all the people who do cement finishing, a quarter of roofers, a quarter of framers for construction, those sorts of things. And so that much of what brought them there was the demand for their labor in those areas.
And the other factor in some of the employers that have felt, I think, pinched by people's concern about why they hired such people will say, and you, the consumer, like those lower prices. The fact that I pay less wages for that person ends up your house costing less than it would cost if I paid some kind of unionized labor. Now, I'm not saying that's right or wrong. I'm simply saying that many people argue at the national level that there's, you know, people don't come, but there's those immigrants as a whole, whether legal or undocumented, don't come if there's not employment. But in particular, the undocumented of Texas, where they come from historically, it has been demand for labor that has caused them to come. And so all I'm saying is that when you look at their characteristics, you know, they're not the only reason that Texas has financial problems. It is because our economy went down, like the rest of the country went down, and it impacted lots of people. And you know, the people who are coming to our emergency rooms are not all undocumented. There's poor folks who are coming who are documented, full-fledged, born in Texas, born in America persons as well. So yes, they impact the process, but if you take Texas and you look at the numbers, that 1.4, the 1.6 million is out of 9.5 million Hispanics. So, you know, there's a real problem in Texas, I think, to think that everybody that's Hispanic is undocumented. That's not true. It's foolish. Many Hispanics have been here longer than the Anglos. Okay. So that we have a lot of full-fledged U.S. citizens in our Hispanic population. But, you know, this is historic. We've done this. We have these issues on immigrants every time the economy gets in trouble. And I think it's important to understand that even though we're a country of immigrants, we've never liked immigrants real well. We didn't like the Irish when they came. What did we say about the Irish? Oh, they were poorly educated. They were dumb.
No Irish need apply.
No Irish need apply. Italians, Germans. You know, I like to say that they didn't call my ancestors mixed because they loved them. They didn't call the Germans Heinies because they loved them. And they didn't call the Italians WAPs because they loved them. In fact, some of the things we've done and said historically about immigrants are interesting. One of my favorites is that Benjamin Franklin, who we think of as a great paragon, if you will, of tolerance and forbearance and so forth, when he was writing Poor Richard's Almanac, and one of the tracts he had, he wrote about a set of folks, and he said, quote, these people, this is a paraphrase, not a quote, he said, these people would come to our colony, they would make their culture our culture, their language our language, and if allowed to continue to grow, they will forever change Pennsylvania as an English colony. He's talking about the Germans. Okay. Well, you know, you may have heard some of those same kind of comments last week or a year ago. When we passed our first immigration laws in the United States in the 1920s, 1920, by the way, that was the only census after which we didn't reapportion the U.S. Congress. And we didn't reapportion it because Congress, there had been tremendous growth in cities of America. And the Congress was disproportionately rural. So they knew any reapportionment was going to mean fewer seats for them from where most of them were, and more seats in urban areas. Well, that was a concern. The other concern was that the growth in urban areas had been Southern Europeans, okay? So it had been Italians and Poles and Russians and so forth. So that when we passed our first immigration laws in the 1920s and set up quotas, okay, we did so using the census not of 1920, but of 1890. Why? So we could exclude the numbers that had come from Southern and Eastern Europe. Okay, so that we wouldn't get any more of those Southern and, you know, these Italians and those Germans and those Russians and so forth. So that
In fact, one more example of that. In 1964, we passed a fairly momentous piece of legislation. In fact, the Texas president passed it, knowing that he was, I think, he thought for a generation, looks like it's several generations, would make the South go Republican and not be a Democratic state relative to Democrats versus Republicans, called the Civil Rights Act. In 1965, we passed the Immigration Act of 1965, and the reason we passed it is that the United States had among the most racist immigration laws in the world. We basically said if you were Hispanic, okay, and you weren't in a Bracero or other kind of managed program, you can't come. We basically said if you were Asian, you couldn't come. Well, of course, when you looked at the world, that meant that we were increasingly cutting out large parts of the world population, because India and China have virtually always been larger than us, even at the beginning of our foundings. And after that, so we said, well, we would set it up on a pure quota system from across the world. That's when you began to see just a tremendous change in documented as well as undocumented immigration. So that we went from a pattern where Europeans were 50-some percent of our migrants, immigrants, down to about 15%. Not because we suddenly decided to discriminate against Europeans, but we decided we wouldn't discriminate against the world, and we would set up our quotas on the basis of people in our country from where they came, and also how many people there were in the world from different parts of the world. So that's when we ended up changing our and if you, and I can give you some, but you'll also look at any chart on immigration and look at it by decade, and you'll see that shift. That shift takes place in the decade of the 70s, or late part of the decade of the 60s and 70s. So my only point is that immigrants have never been all that popular in the U.S., despite the fact that we glorify at various times that all of us are immigrants. And when it comes to particularly bad economic times, immigrants have often been the brunt of our worry and concern. So it's not unusual in a time like we've had, and are in fact in some ways are still having, to have immigration rise as an issue of substantial concern.
Earlier on, you mentioned that the African American and Asian populations in Texas also grew dramatically. What accounts for that?
Well, Asian populations, of course, Asian growth has been more from immigration than some of the Hispanic growth. The African American population grew in Texas. It did not grow everywhere. African Americans now are below replacement fertility. That pattern occurred later, but it has occurred now, so that it's pretty much true. The growth in Texas was what most of the growth in African American populations have been is from one state to another. So we gained some from other states. I think only Georgia had a larger increase in its African American population than we did. So the African American population and its growth, as you look at most of the projections, are that it will stay about the same proportion of the population in the future that's been in the past. Because there's some immigration from Africa. There's a lot of potential there, but immigration from a place such as Africa or Asia is a fairly expensive kind of phenomenon, so it tends to be a more elite group of people who can afford all of the costs of immigration. And so the African-American population is stabilizing. When you look at Texas or a country, most projections say it'll keep about the same 11 to 12% of the population that it has been historically. So the growth there was from certainly for Texas, some of it has been people coming, African Americans coming from other states. You know, what's happened really beginning two or three decades ago is we began to see the reverse flow really, starting about the turn of the 20th century, we began to see, well, actually it was later than that, but it had been the 1920s, and in that period of time,
we began to see substantial out-migration of African-Americans from the South to Detroit, to other places where there were factory and other kinds of jobs. What we've seen in the last two or three decades has been reverse migration, and that is there are numbers of areas where African-Americans have moved back to the South. Probably the best example is Atlanta. Atlanta is that part of Georgia that has had the largest increase. I don't know the exact numbers, but the last numbers I have seen show them as certainly the largest city and urban complex in America relative to the growth of African-American populations. So there's been some flow back. You're seeing some growth in African-American populations in the suburbs. We have suburbanization going on. It's evident in the Dallas area. It's evident in the Houston area in Texas. It may be evident in other areas that I haven't looked at yet, but certainly you see suburbanization in the Houston area. A good example is Fort Bend County, which had a... Fort Bend County is an interesting county in the sense that it is a truly multi-ethnic, multi-racial county. And so from 2000 to 2010, it had 40,000 plus increases in Anglos and African Americans and Hispanics and in Asians. So that it was it wasn't an all group. It was a very multi-ethnic and multi-racial growth pattern. And you're seeing some of that in counties around Dallas as well.
There's a quote of yours that's been going around the newspapers where you said, it's basically over for Anglos. My understanding is that you yourself didn't actually say
that. I didn't say that, yes. What I was talking to a group, and I was talking about demographic patterns, and a questioner actually asked the question, and he prefaced it by saying, he said, well, it sounds to me like you are saying that it's basically over for Anglos. And I said, well, no, I'm not talking about that in any socioeconomic sense. What I'm talking about is demographically. And I said, I said that's one way to characterize it. That's not would necessarily be the way I would say it. But what I was talking about, and we talked about it earlier in our conversation, is to say that in terms of the likelihood that there's going to be a resurgence of Anglo population growth, it's very unlikely. Because of the below replacement fertility and the age structure and the fact that there really aren't a lot of locations or there aren't a lot of origins to send us additional Anglo immigrants. So that it's unlikely that we're going to see a resurgence. That's what I was referring to, not to what it often got attributed to was to all sorts of socioeconomic and political and everything else.
City of Houston disputed its census number, and it seems like, to some extent, that was a matter of counting some people who lived in the city as not being in the city. But the thing that struck me is that if you were following the census population estimates, I mean, it was in 2005 or 2006 that they estimated the city of Houston had hit 2.1 million, and if you kind of worked your way forward, based on that, they should have the city of Houston at over 2.2 million.
Mm-hmm.
What accounts for the difference between the estimates and the actual count?
A lot of things. First of all, they are estimates. And, if you ask me to estimate lots of different things or project lots of different things, estimates and projections are an exact science. And it doesn't matter whether we're talking about the stock market. I mean, go back 5 years ago and look at the projections of how the stock market was going to be doing in 2011. In 2005 and 2006, they would have had it, booming, and now it's kind of puttering along. But what attributed, I think, is part of that was that there were factors that were difficult to estimate. How many people actually came to Houston and stayed in Houston as a result of Katrina? I think the city and the census went through a good deal of debate about how many that was. We probably will never know for sure. And that was an event that's most estimates, whether you're talking about your income estimates next year or estimates of population, are done on the basis of patterns and trends that are fairly linear. Well, something like Katrina is changes all the linearity, and it changes all the patterns, so it becomes much more difficult to do. In general, another factor that impacted many places was the fact that the Census Bureau nationally, and in fact there's a recent thing that came out from Jeff Cassell that talks about the fact that they overestimated Anglos and underestimated Hispanics. And so they underestimated Hispanics. In Texas, you could about trade off 200,000 Anglos for 200,000 Hispanics. But I think when you start looking at a city, you look at the actual difference ended up between 2.1 was about 540 people, something like that. That's less than rounding error. what I'm saying is I think that they did the best they could with the data they had, and some tough things that were fairly difficult to determine, like the actual number of who came and stayed in Houston as a result of Katrina. Obviously simply, if they're wrong, they underestimated they overestimated the amount of growth as a result of migration. Big cities in the country as a whole did less well than I think people thought they were doing. Because if you took, for example, Chicago, in fact, we had a little stir between the time that Illinois came out and Texas came out, because Chicago was about 200,000 lower than they thought they should be from the estimates and from everything else. Okay, and so we had reporters calling, maybe Houston will be bigger. Maybe they'll actually be bigger than Chicago. That's not something most demographers thought would be the case because the difference was too large. But then, of course, Houston came in, and it was lower than what people thought it would be. So many of the cities, and I think what that reflects, is that many cities in the United States continue to have difficulties in terms of retaining population and having population growth. Many cities are struggling. The example that everyone knows that's no surprise at all is poor Detroit. Detroit lost 25% of its population this last decade. It's now a city of 700 and some thousand people. You know, at one time, Detroit was the fifth largest city in the United States. So it has clearly been a rough for many cities. That one, of course, we all know the reasons for that. But most cities, I think, growth was less than what was anticipated. And so what happened is that when you're talking about particularly urban areas versus suburban areas, you see that. And so, the growth in places like the Houston MSA was large. The growth in the Dallas MSA was large. Dallas had even more difficulties than Houston. So large central cities as a whole did worse, I think, than was anticipated, not only by the Census Bureau, but by most demographers generally. The amounts that we're talking about seem like there are a lot of absolute people, but the difference between 2.1 and 2.1 to 150,000, start looking at that base, that's a pretty small error relative to many kinds of estimates and projections. Census Bureau has no stake, I can tell you that, in who grows and who doesn't in terms of the population. So they're pretty straight shooters when it comes to the estimates and projections they do. But estimates and projections, whether you're talking about financial issues or demographic issues, is not a totally exact science.
Okay. And just very briefly, what do you think is likely to be the story of the 2020 census?
Well, I it's always difficult to know. Things can change, but I think we're very likely to see not the level of rates of growth that we've seen in Hispanic and other populations, but I think we're going to continue to see the minority proportions of the total population grow, so that we will be an increasingly diverse nation with a further reducing in terms of the proportion of our population being Anglo. I can see nothing in the cards that's likely to change that. I think we'll see, and it is one of the surprises of the 2010 census, is that many people, including the former director of the census, was convinced that we would see huge increases in the number of people who would say they were from two or more races. Was not much increase at all in that proportion. There's an increase in numbers, but not much increase in proportion. I don't think that necessarily reflects reality. I mean, I think in terms of, I think there is intermarriage and so forth taking place. So I think we will see that increase over time. I don't know anyone that knows exactly what that amount will be. We'll see increasing amounts of intermarriage between our increasingly diverse population base. And I think we'll see, continue to see some very interesting patterns of regional change and growth. I'll be surprised if we don't continue to see the South and the West grow more rapidly than the Northeast and the Midwest. Part of that is simply the cost of building infrastructure versus rebuilding infrastructure, and the latter tends to be more expensive than the former. And so that I think we'll see a growing population. I wouldn't be surprised to see that population growth rate slow down, because we have been, as a country with our demographics, kind of an outlier. We grow much faster than Europe does, for example. Part of that, as I indicated, is our diversity. So, but I think we may, you know, this was the second slowest growth percentage-wise in U.S. history. Only the Great Depression at the national level had a slower rate of growth than we had this decade. I think we may see a slower rate of growth, increased diversification, increasing intermarriage among the racial and ethnic groups. I think we will, it'll be interesting to see how the shifts across states occur. I think Texas will continue to grow. Not at the range that it's been, not at the rate it's been necessarily, but I think it'll continue to grow.
All right. Dr. Steve Murdoch, thank you very much for stopping me.
Thank you.
I appreciate it.